I'm Jim Fleming, and this is the podcast of one segment from To the Best of Our Knowledge, Public Radio's Peabody Award-winning magazine of ideas from PRI, Public Radio International, and Wisconsin Public Radio. What do you call young people who strap on explosive vests and detonate them in a crowded marketplace? President Bush says they're fascist terrorists. The Western press labels them suicide bombers. To a Muslim, particularly one who's sympathetic to their political ideology, they are martyrs, and what they're doing makes perfect sense. This week's excerpt from To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from a program on suicide bombers. From one point of view, the British in India are the classic example of Western imperialism run amok. But it didn't start out that way. In the late 18th century, the British were in India to trade. The Mughals were in charge. Their empire had all the money, all the land, all the power. This is the history William Dalrymple explores in his book. It's called White Mughals, and Salman Rushdie says it is brilliant and compulsively readable. Dalrymple told Steve Paulson who the Mughals were.
The Mughals are the people who built the Taj Mahal, who built the Great Red Fort in Delhi, and in their time, their peak was about the 17th century, they were the richest, most powerful, and most cultured nation on earth. All the diamonds in the world came from their mines. Their fields were full of two harvests a year. Often today, I think we think of India as a place of poverty and a place of distress. The very opposite was true at this period. The Europeans, and particularly the British, came to India to trade because it was so incredibly, fabulously rich. Anyway, that empire, like all empires, eventually went into decline. And this is the period when the Mughals are just finally going down and the British are just beginning to come up.
And James Kirkpatrick goes to India as a representative of the East India Company?
Indeed. And it was thought that he would go there, maybe, you know, introduce some good Western customs, conquer the place, administer it fairly. It didn't work out like that. Instead, he was conquered, not by an army or by military means, but by his love for this incredibly beautiful, initially 14-year-old Hyderabadi noblewoman.
Hmm. So what happened? He saw this beautiful girl and just fell in love right there?
Well, it's clear that from the very beginning, he was half in love with India. His response to India was very emotional. He thought it was an incredibly beautiful place. He loved the culture. He'd been born there. And his mother had died when he was only 2 years old. And I think he'd been brought up by Indian nannies. And I suspect, although I can't prove it, that his first language probably was Tamil or Hindi rather than English, because his father would have been a fairly distant figure. And the people who must have brought him up must have been Indian. So when he returned as a teenager, probably about the age of 18, to India as a young diplomat, I mean, it's clear that he thought he was coming home in many ways. And in a sense, there are two things that I'm trying to do with this book. It's, although at its heart, it's just a fabulous story, a fabulous true love story. I think it has two very important resonances for today. The first is that it shows an image of Muslim women and an image of Islam, which is utterly different to the stereotypes you get today. The Muslim women in this book are as different from the sort of downtrodden, chador-wearing Taliban sort of beehives you see on the telly, as it's possible to be. At the heart of the book lies four generations of incredibly strong, independent, well-educated, sassy women who get their way. They run rings not only around their own menfolk, but also around the British. And so in a sense, one thing I'm trying to do in this book is to show how very different Islam was in those days. We are quite at ease with the idea that Christians are different, that, you know, a Southern Baptist is different from a Serbian war criminal, or, you know, an Italian Roman Catholic is different from, I don't know, from a Swiss Calvinist. That is something we're quite used to. But in a sense, I think many people see Islam as one massive, undifferentiated mass full of terrorists and full of sort of people with daggers in their mouths and making threatening noises at the West. Islam is a vast, vast, vast world religion. And in the course of history, there have been many different Islams. The Islam which developed in the Mughal period was incredibly civilized, tolerant, and mixed with Hinduism and Christianity in a way that's as far different from the Islam of Osama bin Laden as is possible to imagine. So one of the things I think that this book does, I would hope, is that it would present in a very accessible form an image of Islam which might surprise many people, and I hope would come as an encouragement to many people.
And you said there was a second point you wanted to
make? The second point, I think, is the image of the British in the book. I think anyone who bothers thinking about the British in India have this very clear stereotype in their mind of some sort of arrogant idiot with a solar topi on his head, with his nose in the air, disdaining the people and the culture of India when he's not actually gunning them down in some dreadful massacre. The British at the period I'm writing about, which is this brief and very interesting period between about 1760 and 1820, 1830, again, are as different from that stereotype as you can imagine. They wear Indian clothes, they like Indian food, they dress in Indian clothes, they like Indian music, they write Urdu and Persian poetry.
Well, and you cite a statistic that I found amazing, that a lot of British men who went over there ended up living with Indian women, something like in the early years, 1 in 3.
1 in 3. This is, again, the most striking statistic, I think, to show how different it is from anything that people imagine.
And these were not just relationships. So it was sort of the master white man with his
colonial
native
slave.
Concubine.
Absolutely not. Although there was that there. You know, we're talking about human relationships, and they vary from relationship to relationship. So one must be careful not to whitewash these things. Slavery was an institution at this time, and you do find a minority, but a significant minority, say one-fifth of the relationships between British men and Indian women are slave-master relationships. That said, four-fifths are not. Four-fifths are relationships of usually free and equal people choosing to be together, often in the face of quite considerable odds. And as I say, in 1780s, you get literally 1 in 3 British men cohabiting with Indian women.
But what's interesting about this is, I mean, you're really talking about multiculturalism.
It is exactly multiculturalism.
To use that catchword from today, I mean, but this happened 300 years ago.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And what I think the anomaly is not the 18th century when this went on, because this happened, I think, throughout history. The anomaly is the late 19th century when the British weirdly, sort of spectacularly, sort of fail to acclimatize themselves to India. So, you know, in the famous image, you have a lone British official sitting in white tie in the jungle in Bengal, dressing for dinner in this incredibly formal dinner jacket, tuxedo, eating his, you know, meal alone on a veranda as if he's sitting in, you know, Buckingham Palace. That, to an anthropologist, is something weird, interesting, and strange.
So why did that happen? Why did it shift from this incredible openness, this mutual respect between these two cultures, to this high Victorian arrogance and racism toward the
straightforward
the
racism
natives?
By the Victorian period, absolutely no doubt about it. I think there are two or three interesting things going on. The first is there's a change in British society. You're moving from the world of Johnson and Boswell of the 18th century, where Boswell, you know, can whores and drinks his way through London, visits 15 prostitutes in a week, tells his wife about it, writes about it in his diary, utterly unembarrassed licentiousness, to the world of the Victorian chapel, whereby the 1830s, the Victorians' idea of a good time is to spend 7 hours listening to a sermon in some chapel. So that's one change. You get a profound change in British society. And these things go in fashions. I mean, in our own time, we've seen the change, say, from the 1960s, the flower children, through to the Reaganite conservatism of the late 80s. So you have fashions in sexuality, you have fashions in dress, you have fashions in everything. And so I think one thing that happens is the British are becoming simply more conservative and more religious. The second thing that happens is that Indian Muslims are changing. In the 18th century, Indian Muslims embrace a very Sufi sort of Islam, which is very tolerant, very pluralistic, is very open-minded, and very attractive to us. And as I say, the Islam of this period in India is a deeply attractive religion. It's not the sort of authoritarian, cold Islam of the fundamentalists. It's a very warm and pluralistic religion that sees God within the individual, that's open to other religions, that the Sufi shrines, you have Hindus and Christians coming and praying all together. That changes in the mid-19th century for a variety of reasons. And you move towards this more hardline form of Islam, again, of the sort we see today. And indeed, the Deoband Madrasa, which is the spiritual ancestor of the Taliban, the direct line of spiritual teaching which led to the Taliban, begins at this period in Delhi, And so you have not only the British becoming more conservative, more narrow-minded, the same thing's happening in Indian Muslims. And thirdly, you're having the British suddenly realizing that they're all-powerful, and with power comes arrogance. And so they suddenly think that they haven't got anything to learn from India. Hinduism, which when the British first came across it, was a subject of sort of fascinated inquiry. All these British guys are busy collecting Sanskrit texts and trying to understand what's going on, often getting it wrong. Nonetheless, there is a real desire to want to learn about this culture and learn about the history of these people. But by the mid-19th century, the British think they've got nothing to learn from India. They've got a lot to teach India, they think. And so Hindus are just regarded now not as interesting subjects of study, but poor, benighted heathen who are ripe for conversion. And the missionaries come in and start preaching about the abomination of devilry that Hinduism is. And so it's a mixture, I think, of social attitudes, and also it's a mixture of arrogance and economic and military power that brings that on.
But that's fascinating, because you're saying that really when the British Empire first took root in India, that whole overlay of racism really was absent.
Completely absent. But I think the mistake you made in that was when the British Empire took root. The British came to India as traders. And what's fascinating, and I think again something that has contemporary resonance, is that the attitudes begin to change when they move from being traders in coastal ports doing business with Indians to the moment when suddenly they find themselves the sole superpower in the subcontinent. Initially, there are a great number of very sophisticated Indian armies. And as late as 1764, there's a battle at a place called Polulur, where an Indian Muslim ruler called Tipu Sultan crushingly defeats the British and takes prisoner 1 in 5 British men in India. And this, along with Yorktown, when you guys throw us out of America, is one of the two great sort of crushing British defeats. So it's very important to think of this early period of the British in India, not in terms of the British Empire, but early British colonialism, early British trade, with a civilization that was richer, often much more civilized, often equally technologically advanced, particularly military matters. And it's at that period that you get this interchange. Where it stops, and I think this is again why it's an interesting moment to be talking about this book in America, is that the British defeat the last two major Indian powers quite rapidly. Tipu Sultan is taken out in 1799, and the Marathas, who are the other great force in India, are taken out in 1805. And it takes about sort of 10 years for the British to realise, for the penny to drop, that now they can do whatever they like. And if they want to remake India in a way that they think it needs to be remade, so they find Eastern customs they find disgusting and tyrannical, such as sati, the burning of widows, and they ban it. And it's at this period that absolute power turns into arrogance. And I think, you know, in a sense, that there are many warnings for the United States in the mistakes that the British made when they were the sole superpower. I mean, there has to be. Famously, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think, you know, America now finds itself absolutely powerful.
William Dalrymple calls his book White Mughals, Love and Betrayal in 18th Century India. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You've been listening to a segment from PRI's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Public Radio's Peabody Award-winning magazine of ideas. If you would like to hear the program in its entirety, visit ttbook.org or check with your local public radio station. You can also download the entire hour at audible.com/ttbook.